there was an old lion who drank at the same water hole in Africa every night, so much so that he thought he owned the water hole. So every night after he drank, he would lie down in the path leading down to the water hole, and it cost any animal that came along. Well, this one night, a zebra came along. And the lion rose up and said in his deepest voice, "Who's the king of beasts?" The zebra said, "Why, you are, sir," very obsequiously. And the lion said, "You may pass and drink." Next, a tiny gazelle came along. And the lion rose up and said, "Who's the king of beasts?" And the gazelle was so frightened, almost collapsed. But it finally came out with the right answer. And the lion said, "You may pass and drink." Next came along a 6-ton bull elephant. And the lion came up to his full height, roared in its very loudest voice, "Who's the king of beasts?" And the bull elephant had a bad day, picked him up in his trunk, tossed him back in the jungle. Lion limped back to the edge of the jungle and yelled out, "Just because you don't know the answer, you don't have to get so damn mad." What I've chosen to talk about today is the nuclear fuel challenge of the 1980s. Now, most of the commercial nuclear power plants in operation in the United States in the 1980s will be light water reactors. The remainder will be high-temperature gas-cooled reactors. Both of these reactor types have conversion ratios of less than unity and therefore are net consumers of uranium. The former produces about half as much fuel as it consumes, the latter about two-thirds. During the next 15 years, the nation's nuclear electric generating capacity will increase rapidly from about 26,000 megawatts today to about 100,000 megawatts in 1980 to about 460,000 megawatts in 1990. This means that the plutonium and U-233 bred in LWRs and HTGRs respectively will contribute little to the total nuclear fuel requirements of the 1980s. Most of these requirements will have to be satisfied by mining, milling, purifying, transforming, enriching, and fabricating virgin uranium. Recognizing this, we are face to face with the challenges my subject refers to. They include finding and producing the vast amount of U-308 required, chemically transforming this U-308 to UF6, enriching the UF6, fabricating enriched uranium into high-quality fuel elements at a reasonable cost, transporting and reprocessing spent fuel elements at a reasonable cost, disposing of the radioactive waste, safeguarding both enriched uranium and the secondary fuels bred in the fertile material associated with that enriched uranium, and finally, raising the necessary capital for these expensive undertakings. Obviously, I do not have time to discuss all of these challenges. Weighing my desire to give you a comprehensive picture against my orders to stay within the time limit allotted to me, I've decided to concentrate on the three challenges that appear to be the most important. And they are, first, finding and producing the vast amount of uranium required. Second, enriching this uranium. Finally, safeguarding both enriched uranium and bred fuels. And if you disagree with my selections, I'd certainly like to hear your thoughts in the discussion period. On top of its other woes, the nuclear power industry is now suffering rampant and rather erratic escalation of uranium ore prices. The basic reason for this is that proven ore reserves are not adequate to meet the demand of the early 1980s, and utility companies who are operating or building nuclear power plants are scrambling to tie up enough fuel to keep their plants going through the next decade. A secondary reason is that the AEC now requires fixed delivery of uranium in order to obtain enrichment services. Market conditions are rather chaotic at present, to put it mildly. Not only domestic, but also foreign utility companies are requesting quotations from U.S. suppliers. In some cases, foreign buyers are offering to pay substantially higher prices than domestic buyers. The current price range in the spot market is therefore quite wide, from $11 to $16 per pound. This variation will narrow markedly by the end of the year, I believe. That's the good news. The bad news is that it will probably home in on the upper end of the scale. There are other reasons besides inadequate proven reserves and the recent changes in AEC enrichment policy for these chaotic market conditions, however. Among them are the even faster price increases for competing fuels, coal, oil, and gas, and the general unavailability of these fuels for generation of electricity at the present time. Also, the marginal producers that were enticed into the business by the booming market of the 1960s have now all but disappeared from the scene, thus reducing competition. Add to these factors the increased difficulty in locating and developing newer ore bodies and the effects of the spiraling inflation the world is suffering, and you have a bad scene. Enough of a challenge to make even a modern Hercules ponder before undertaking it. Utility companies are not the only organizations being hurt by the unsettled uranium ore market. Manufacturers of nuclear fuel are also being hurt, particularly those who are short in their U-308 requirements. They are short only because they counted on buying uranium when needed at a price below the sum of what they would have had to pay earlier, plus normal carrying charges. But uranium prices have escalated much faster than expected and are now well beyond that sum. This could spell trouble for certain manufacturers unless the price of uranium comes back down. There will be occasional downward turns in the price of uranium, but generally the trend will be up, for all the reasons I have mentioned. Even small decreases in price over a period of a year could have disastrous effects on certain manufacturers, however. Take the case of the company that buys its uranium at the last minute for a large throughput, say 5,000 tons. If the average price of this ore goes down $1 per pound during that year, the company must absorb an inventory loss of $10 million, which could wipe out its entire profit on those cores. If we had open worldwide trading for yellowcake and a futures market to boot, it would be relatively easy for both utility companies and manufacturers to protect themselves from the risks that I've outlined. We have neither of these commercial arrangements, however, and the organizations in the nuclear fuel business are therefore forced to speculate. Part of the challenge I'm talking about is to set up open worldwide trading and a futures market. Now, the uranium business wasn't always this bad. How and why did it deteriorate? I think that history tells the tale. From the inception of the uranium mining and milling industry in 1948 until the early 1960s, the AEC was the sole purchaser of uranium and negotiated prices on the basis of production costs. In 1956, the AEC announced a uniform price of $8 per pound for producers under government contract and gave the industry permission to make commercial sales, both policies to be effective in 1962. These policies were indeed put into effect that year. The $8 price was originally scheduled to be terminated in 1966, but a stretch-out program extended it, in certain cases, to 1970. Commercial sales began in 1967. Prices fell to about $5 per pound shortly thereafter and were still as low as $6 per pound for near-term deliveries in early 1973, just last year. Then the lid blew off. Environmental restraints eliminated the possibility of large increases in the use of conventional fuels to solve the energy crisis. Sales of nuclear power plants boomed. Rampant inflation raised the cost of everything, including exploring for and producing uranium ore. Good uranium deposits became harder to find. The current average price of, say, $13 per pound will probably rise to $16 per pound by the end of the year, as I've indicated. In 1980, it will probably be $25 per pound, and these are all constant dollars. I've mentioned two ways to tackle the uranium problem: open worldwide trading and a futures market. These do not get to the heart of the matter, however. That can be done only by finding and developing much more ore than we are consuming. In other words, increasing supply above demand. And this is the other part of the challenge I'm talking about. And what are your prospects if you decide to quit your engineering job today and go out looking for uranium? Very dim. The business of finding and developing uranium ore bodies has become unbelievably sophisticated and expensive. For example, it costs 5 times as much to drill exploratory holes today as it did 10 years ago. For another example, the measures an owner must take to protect uranium miners from health hazards have run extraction costs up threefold over those in 1965. Discovery of new uranium deposits in the United States during the past 3 years has barely kept up with production. Both concentration and size of new finds are trending downward. The foreign picture is similar, except in Australia. South African production is largely tied to its production of gold. As the price of gold rises, lower and lower grade ores are mined. These ores are also low in uranium content. Therefore, since there is no incentive to increase uranium milling capacity, less uranium ore is produced. The Rossing deposit, a recently developed lode of low-grade ore in South Africa, is still being worked, but its milling capacity is sold out for at least 10 years, and new capacity would take at least 3 years to construct. Canada's ore production is almost fully committed under firm contracts for the entire foreseeable future. In May, Rio Tinto Zinc sold 20 million pounds of yellowcake to the British for delivery in 1983 to 1992. The price was not divulged, but spokesmen for RTZ have indicated a level of about $13 per pound for current production, with full escalation. They have also indicated that if the world price is higher than the price established by this formula at any given time, they will sell at the higher price. World price would be decided by binding arbitration in the event of disagreement between buyer and seller. Few Canadian producers will quote for any kind of delivery at present. Exploration in Canada has been greatly accelerated during the past 3 years, but there have been no significant discoveries. France, too, is essentially out of the uranium market. Its main problems are international politics and racial difficulties. The current output of its African mines is now being fully utilized by EDF. Australia, on the other hand, has had a great deal of success in locating significant ore bodies in recent years. But these bodies are mostly located in the inaccessible area southeast of Darwin. Massive development of that entire area, including the building of highways, railroads, and towns, will be necessary before the uranium can be brought out. Also, because Australia's economy is booming at present, the government is taking the long-range view with respect to nuclear development and is insisting that uranium produced in that country be enriched and possibly also fabricated into fuel elements before export. Therefore, uranium mining in Australia is at a standstill, for no facilities exist for upgrading the ore, and they will probably not exist until sometime in 1980. Nevertheless, exploration for uranium continues, and additional discoveries will probably be made in the next few years. We know there is plenty of uranium in the crust of the earth. The challenge is to find it, and to bring it out of the ground at the right time and lowest possible cost. With the cost of conventional fuel spiraling out of sight, the price pinch on uranium has eased, and less concentrated or more inaccessible deposits can now be utilized. If the price doubles from $15 per pound to $30 per pound, the estimated reserves of the free world will probably rise from about 1 million tons to about 2.5 million tons. And this is enough fuel to keep the worldwide nuclear industry going with LWRs and HTGRs until well into the 21st century. The second of the major nuclear fuel challenges of the 1980s is provision of adequate enrichment capacity. This challenge was colored bright orange last month when the AEC pulled the curtain down on long-term contracts for enrichment services. The reason for this move, as many of you know, was that the AEC is not empowered to make commitments beyond its current production capability. Although everyone in the nuclear industry was well aware of this limitation on the AEC's enrichment contracting ability, many were hoping that congressional action or some other minor miracle would keep the AEC going. The miracle did not occur, and the industry has suffered another setback. There are no less than 20 domestic and 78 foreign nuclear power projects in the application line when the curtain was drawn. What will happen to these projects is anybody's guess. My feeling is that they will hang on for at least a year in most cases, trusting that the U.S. government will not let them down. In their present operating mode, the three large U.S. enriching plants at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, Paducah, Kentucky, and Portsmouth, Ohio, can support about 350,000 megawatts of electric generating capacity, assuming a reasonable amount of plutonium recycle. At the cutoff date, the AEC had contracted for enrichment services sufficient to sustain 273,000 megawatts of electric capacity, and had applications before it that would have boosted the total to 365,000 megawatts above its capacity. There are several ways out of the awkward position the AEC finds itself in. It can increase its pre-production inventory. It can increase the tails assay of its production lines. It can build, or foreign governments can build, or industry can build, additional capacity in time to satisfy the demand. Route number one would cost the U.S. quite a bit of money on a present worth basis. Route number two would require added uranium feed and would aggravate the already bad raw materials problem. Route number three appears to be the only reasonable solution. What is being done to prepare for construction of this additional capacity? The AEC is, of course, conducting its own studies and laying its own plans. I shall not speculate on what the AEC will do. I am strongly of the opinion that industry must rise to meet this challenge. Uranium Enrichment Associates, the Westinghouse-Bechtel Union Carbide Combination, has made proposals to a number of utility companies and has obtained an option on land in Alabama suitable for a 9,000-ton SWU gaseous diffusion plant. UEA will not go ahead with this project, however, unless it gets the required utility company backing and unless its board has sufficient evidence in hand that a gaseous diffusion plant will be competitive long enough to amortize the very large investment involved. Gexco, the General Electric Exxon joint venture, is concentrating on gas centrifuge technology and is preparing model contracts for submittal to potential customers within the year. Electronucleonics and several partners are examining the possibility of building a regional enrichment plant of the gaseous diffusion type in conjunction with TVA. These private ventures have been spawned from the AEC's Uranium Enrichment Access Program, which was set up 2 years ago to encourage construction of privately owned isotope separation plants through various forms of technical assistance and financial support. In the foreign area, the industrial European nations, South Africa, the USSR, and Canada are all taking aggressive action to solve the international enrichment problem. France has started work on a 9,000-ton SWU Eurodiff plant, another gaseous diffusion unit. It is scheduled for operation in the early 1980s. The two nuclear stations that will provide electric power for the facility are already under construction. Urenco Centec, the German-Dutch-United Kingdom centrifuge troika, has developed a firm design for a 2,000-ton SWU plant for operation in 1980 or 1981. The Soviets are making a small portion of their gaseous diffusion capacity available to other nations on a special call basis. Commercial intelligence sources indicate that new gaseous diffusion capacity is being built in Siberia. Following their startling announcement several years ago of a breakthrough in enrichment technology, the South Africans have clammed up and remain an enigma in the enrichment field. The Brinko Group in Canada has announced plans to build a 9,000-ton SWU plant of the gaseous diffusion type near a new large hydroelectric facility. These plans are contingent on Canada's ability, of course, to obtain the necessary technical information from the United States. Finally, there is Congressman Hosmer's plan, which I consider quite sound. He has proposed legislation to create an interim government corporation like ComSat, which would take over the existing AEC enrichment plants, build and operate new plants as required, encourage private enterprise to enter the business, and then bow out gradually as private enterprise takes over. Now, which of these projects will actually materialize would be difficult to predict. Since my mission today is pinpointing problems, not forecasting solutions, I leave you to your own thoughts on that score. I would not be doing a good job of outlining this particular problem, however, if I did not stress how crucial it is. As things are going now, lack of enrichment capacity could begin to throttle the entire nuclear industry as early as 1982. Prevention of this disaster requires high-caliber industrial leadership, persistent and intelligent work by many qualified engineers and technicians, good government planning, and a certain degree of luck. Among the obstacles to be surmounted are the high classification of enrichment data, raising the huge amounts of capital required, the unknowns in gas centrifuge technology. This technology, incidentally, appears promising, but no one has built and tested full-scale production components as yet. Therefore, judging the relative economics is a tremendous gamble. And four, the possibility of technological breakthroughs with laser or other advanced processes. Laser technology is developing at a rate reminiscent of the growth of the computer industry in the 1960s. If its basic promise in the enrichment field holds, an investment in either a gaseous diffusion or a gas centrifuge facility could be money down a rat hole in just a few years. The enrichment business is a massive puzzle at the moment, a fit subject for the best brains of the country to spend time on. The only thing that is certain is that for the economic health, yes, even the survival of the nation, the key to the puzzle must be found. And the last of the three challenges I want to lay before you, and I'll make this brief, is prevention of diversion of special nuclear material, that is, enriched uranium and or bred fuels, for illegal purposes. The safeguards challenge is not new, and it has not been neglected by the nuclear industry, as some critics would have the public think. We have only small flows of special nuclear material to deal with at present, and there is time to develop the procedures necessary to handle the physical security problem when it does become critical. This does not mean that we can relax, however, because these procedures will be difficult to work out. Despite the formidable nature of the task, there are several reasons why we can expect success. One of these is that on the reprocessing end of the fuel cycle, special nuclear material will consist largely of either plutonium with a high 240 or 242 content, or U-233, both of which must be refabricated behind heavy shielding by remote control. Also, nuclear power plants provide an ideal framework for physical security measures and new and improved techniques for detection and measurement of special nuclear material are being developed. The nuclear fuel cycle is presently vulnerable enough at several points, however, including shipment of uranium from the enrichment plant, fabrication of fresh fuel, and shipment of recovered fuel, to warrant the recent AEC-initiated acceleration of safeguards action. A primary objective is to achieve closer collaboration between industry and federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies. If the recent campaign waged by these agencies to prevent the hijacking of airplanes is a good parallel, and I believe it is, the safeguards program for special nuclear material should be extremely effective. Any system set up to cope with the safeguards problem must be flexible enough to accommodate myriad changes, and it must be manned by intelligent and perceptive personnel who will adjust their thinking and methods to achieve the spirit instead of just the letter of the law. Nuclear plant personnel, on the other hand, cannot assume the responsibilities of law enforcement bodies or the armed forces in carrying out a safeguards program, although they in many cases will be the first to detect suspicious activities or operational anomalies. This gives the matter of attitude and communication a special significance. The necessity for U-235 vis-a-vis plutonium safeguards is perhaps best delineated by a comparison of anticipated fissile material flows in the nuclear industry during the next two decades. It appears that in 1980, a diversion of over 2% of the U-235 being loaded into HCGRs, but only about 0.5% of the plutonium produced by LWRs would be required to pose a real threat. In 1985, the two ratios would be reduced to about 0.5% and about 0.1%, respectively. In 1980, they would, of course, be very much smaller. Now, these figures point to three conclusions, two of which are obvious. Plutonium will be more of a safeguards threat than U-235 in the near term. Neither will cross the danger threshold until 1980. And much more attention and effort must be devoted to safeguards in 1990 than in 1980. The penalty for not recycling plutonium in the LWR would be on the order of $250 million per year in 1980, increasing to about $1 billion per year in 1990. Similarly, the penalty for using the low enrichment fuel cycle in the HDGR would range from about $4 million per year to about $200 million per year in the same time period. In view of the magnitude of these numbers, the nuclear industry can well afford to spend quite a bit of money on safeguards. A $10 million safeguards cost distributed over the total HDGR generating expense for the year 1985 would amount to less than 1%. Concentrated on reprocessing, however, this same cost would amount to about 40%. If safeguards requirements are carefully planned and are spelled out well in advance of business commitments, appropriate adjustments can be made in pricing, and the costs associated with these requirements can be accommodated. To prevent heavy and unnecessary industry burdens for safeguards, however, we must analyze our problems early and carefully, do our planning well, and get ready with deliberate urgency to put our plans into effect on an optimum schedule. Looking forward to 1990, when requirements for physical protection, detection, monitoring, and assaying of special nuclear material will be considerably more stringent than in 1980, we feel pushed already to develop the necessary facilities and procedures, because, as I have said, they must be ready in time to permit appropriate pricing adjustments on the fuel services involved. To procrastinate in this matter is to court financial disaster. By the same token, we cannot afford to have imposed on us tougher restraints and more rigorous specifications than necessary at any given time. We don't want too little, and we can't afford too much. The tightrope is thin and high, but it must be walked by both the AEC and industry if the nuclear business is to survive. Thank you.
Thank you. Now we'll have the question period. While the panel's coming up here, why don't you just stand up and take a break in place? Now the ground rules are that we have the microphones, one here, and I think there's one in the middle there, and one over there, and there are monitors there to help you find them. And when you're going to ask a question, remember that it's being taped, and please give your name and, if possible, your affiliation. Okay, can we sit down now?
You want a drink?
Before we ask for questions from the floor, would any of the panelists like to briefly comment on what the other panelists have said?
I favor beer as a unit.
It's two.
I want to know how many barrels of beer there are and a ton of coal, too. Okay, now we have a question. Gentleman back here.
Just as an introduction.
Wait a minute. Give me your name.
Okay, thank you very much. Carl Flick, Westinghouse Electric Corporation. Thanks for reminding me, Mr. Barnes. Just as an introduction, I understand that alcohol is being considered as a very reliable substitute for other kinds of fuels, and I would like to know what the alcohol equivalent would be, but that's only as a starter. Now, having listened to the four speakers, if they have alluded, it has been only very peripherally, to the island country of Japan. It's been my observation that for the last 120 years at least, the history of Japan and the history of the United States have been very closely integrated. From the beginning of the so-called opening of Japan by Commodore Perry for the purpose of, for the intended purpose of opening coal refueling stations, all the way through the present time when nuclear stations are apparently going up faster there than they are here. I'm not necessarily expecting a question, an answer to this question, but I would like any of the panelists who feel so inclined to comment on the integration between